Congratulations, boy.
Many gave their lives that we might stand here once again, united in the government of a lawful republic.
Gaius Octavian was henceforth to be regarded, for all intents and purposes, as my lawful son.
Gaius Octavian.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Life of Augustus Caesar, episode 18. How are you, buddy?
Fine. How are you doing, Cam?
Oh, good. I've had more emails from upset Christians.
So it's a good week.
I've had Scientologists upset with me because I said Xenu is not really out there. I've had emails from, upset Norse mythologists because I suggested Loki and Thor aren't really sitting on top of Mount Olympus. Where were they? Was that where the Norse gods were? I can't remember.
I don't know.
All of but these people with their delicate sensibilities about their weird bronze or Iron Age mythologies that they cling close to, getting offended. So last time, we finished off at a really weird place, and we're just going to pick up from there, and hopefully you remember where we're up to, because we don't.
It will make sense this time.
Oh,
before we jump into this, can I just give you an idea of why Antony's fleet is so big? As big as it is, he still doesn't work on land. But just let me give you a little backstory about a part of a reason why his fleet is so big. So when Cassius and Brutus were still alive and in Asia Minor, there was a guy working for them named Parmesius Cassius. No relation. Cassius and Brutus gave him an army and a fleet. They told him to go collect money. Just don't stop. Just keep going throughout Asia Minor. Collect as much money as you can, because you cannot get us enough. So you just keep doing that. But eventually this other Cassius hears that Cassius is dead, but Brutus isn't dead yet. So this other Cassius takes... He's got a whole bunch of Rhodian ships. He takes 30 of them. He burns the rest so they can't revolt. And so he leaves with his ships and those 30 ships. Meanwhile, there's another person whose name is Clodius, obviously a different Clodius. He has been sent by Brutus to Rhodes with 13 more ships to find out what's going on. And Clodius finds out that Rhodes, even without their ships, are in rebellion. So that Clodius gathers up all the soldiers there that are loyal to Brutus and Cassius. There's about 3,000 soldiers, gathers them up, and they join with another fleet that has a whole bunch of ships, a whole bunch of money, again from Rhodes. Rhodes really got raped over and over and over again for the last couple of years, financially and almost every other way that they could, by the Romans. And so they start to gather this fleet, and then a few more small groups of ships join them. Even the son of Cicero joins them for a while, and they all sail back to the Adriatic, and they join another fleet with a man named Mercus and a Hanabarbus. So there's this massive fleet. They can pretty much control everything, the Adriatic, the Aegean, everything, but what they can't do is turn all those ships into men. So as impressive as all this is for Mark Antony, he still has to face the tactical military situation in front of him, the reality of the situation, and you can't just change it by wishful thinking. He's got to deal with the cards he has been dealt.
He's reached both armies that Agrippa had captured Sepuntum, and that Pompeius had been repulsed from Thurii, but was still besieging Consentia. Antony was disturbed by this news. When it was announced that Servilius was coming to the assistance of Octavian with 1,500 horse, Antony could not restrain his rage, but sprang up from supper, and with such friends as he could find ready and with 400 horse, he pressed forward with the utmost intrepidity and fell upon the 1,500, who were still asleep near the town of Hyria, threw them into a panic, captured them without a fight, returned to Brundisium, and continued his meal.
Damn, that's something the Caesar would have done.
She doesn't say he continued his meal. It says he returned to Brundisium the next day, but the same day. But that's my, he sits down, his meal's still hot. He goes out, captures the 1,500 horse, And sits down and goes, right, now where were we?
That's right. We were about to give thanks, yes.
I love both of those stories. That sending private citizens over at night and bringing them back during the day dressed as soldiers, just classic.
Yeah,
classic Antony. But yeah, as it...
No, go ahead.
I was just going to talk about the fact that they weren't able to go to war with each other because they weren't allowed to.
Yeah, it turns out that as powerful as Mark Antony is, as powerful as Caesar's power, as Sextius, as powerful as Ahenobarbus is, there is something more powerful than all of them put together. And this time we're not talking about any body part of Cleopatra. It's the men themselves.
Yeah. So, yeah, so all these, you know, this is one of these stories. We've heard it several times before in the show, and it's sort of reminiscent of, you know, World War One Christmas stories. These two sides are facing off at Brundusium, and it, you know, and Phil turns up, and one of the other guys goes, Phil! He goes, Bob, is that you? Yeah!
Yeah, it's me.
My twin brother, what are you doing over there? I don't know. Octavian thought I was you for some reason, and
he wants me to kill you.
He called me over to ask me why you keep seeing you turn up day after day, and I don't know. Now I'm on his side. I don't know how it happened, really.
It's complicated.
So, yeah, they start talking to each other, basically, the two sides, and because they're colleagues. They're former colleagues. It's all ridiculous.
Some of them know. Yeah, some of them have literally fought together. They know each other. They're like, this is pretty fucked up, don't you think? Yeah. Yes, it is, Bill. Yes, it is.
Appian writes, Antony's Praetorian cohorts, proud of his prestige, approached the camp of Octavian in groups and reproached their former comrades for coming hither, not thither, just hither, to fight Antony. Why did you come hither? Well, we were going thither. I don't want to talk about thither. Let's just focus on hither right now.
That's right.
We'll get to thither later.
Hither now, thither later.
To whom they all owe, although their safety at Philippi. So they're like, look, you know, if it wasn't for Antony, we'd all be dead now. How can you be fighting him?
That makes sense.
When the latter replied that the others had come making war against themselves, like we were just sitting here hanging out, dude. Like you rocked up with Ahenobarbus. You know, we didn't start this shit.
Yeah, the traitor.
They fell to arguing and brought charges against each other. Antony's men said that Brundusium had been closed against him and that Calenus's troops had been taken from him, while the others spoke of the investment and siege of Brundusium, the invasion of southern Italy, the agreement with Ahenobarbus, one of Caesar's murderers, and the treaty with Pompeius, their common enemy. Finally, Octavian's men revealed their purpose to the others, saying that they had come with Octavian not because they were forgetful of Antony's merits, but with the intention of bringing them to an agreement. Or, if Antony refused and continued the war, of defending Octavian against him. These things they openly said also when they approached Antony's works.
Nice.
But then there's this guy.
Oh, there's always one. There's always fucking one.
No, but you know, this is a guy. No, he's a friend of Antony's.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is probably the greatest name. Like titty pussy bumhole is a great name. We love Titus Labius Anus.
Right.
Like you know, they don't come much better than that. Except this.
Right.
Lucius Coccius Nerva. A.K.A.
The nerve of his cock.
The nervous cock. He was known as the nervous cock. Now,
there's this
you know, his last name, Nerva. Uh-huh. He came up with that himself.
Yeah, good for
his
him.
His name was, you know, his nomen was Coccius. And he's like,
yeah,
I'm a little bit nervous. I had to call myself the nervous cock.
He should have went with Erectius.
Yeah. Meterus longius. 12us inches.
Tripodius. Okay. It's time to grow up. All right. Yeah.
So the nervous cock, he's an experienced senior officer. Despite the fact that people laugh whenever he walks past, And he goes first to Antony to get his side of the story. Then he goes to Octavian. And there's a really interesting dialogue between the two of them that Appian has recorded. When Octavian saw him, he expressed astonishment that he had not come sooner. "I did not save your brother," he exclaimed. He was the sturdy cock. "I did not save your brother," he exclaimed, "in order that you should be my enemy." Nervy Cock replied, "How is it that you, who make friends out of enemies, call your friends enemies and take from them their armies and provinces?" "It was not fitting," replied Octavian, "that after the death of Calenus, such large resources should be left in the hands of somebody called Fufikins, while Antony was still far distant. Lucius was excited to frenzy by them, and Asinius and Ahenobarbus, who were nearby, were about to use them against us. So I took sudden possession of the legions of Plancus in order that they might not join the Pompeians." His cavalry had actually gone to Sicily. "These matters have been told differently," said the nervous cock. "But even Antony did not credit the statements made to him until he was shut out of Brundusium as an enemy." "I gave no order on that subject," replied Octavian, "for I did not know beforehand that he was coming, nor did I anticipate that he would come here with enemies. The Brundusiums themselves and the prefect, who had been left with them on account of the raids of Ahenobarbus, of their own motion excluded Antony, who was in league with the common enemy, Pompeius, and was bringing in Ahenobarbus, one of my father's murderers, who had been condemned by vote of the Senate, by judgment of the court, and by the prescription, who besieged Brundusium after the Battle of Philippi, and is still blockading the Adriatic coast, who has burned my ships and plundered Italy." "But it was agreed between you," said the nervous cock, "that you might treat with whomsoever you chose. Yet Antony has not made a treaty with any of the murderers, and he holds your father in no less honour than you do. Ahenobarbus was not one of the murderers, but the vote was cast against him on account of personal animosity, for he had no share whatever in the plots of those days. If we consider him unpardonable, because he was a friend of Brutus, are we not in a fair way to be bitter against almost everybody? Antony made an agreement with Pompeius not to make an aggressive war with him, but either to secure his help in case of an attack by you, or to bring him into good relations with you, since even he has done nothing which should make him irreconcilable. You are the one to blame for these things. For if there had been no war in Italy, those men would not have ventured to send ambassadors to Antony." Octavian repeated his accusations, saying, "Manius and Fulvia and Lucius brought war against Italy and against me as well as Italy. And Pompeius, who did not attack before, now makes descents upon the coast encouraged by Antony." The nervous cock replied, "Not encouraged by Antony, but directed by him, for I'll not conceal from you the fact that the rest of Italy, which is destitute of naval defences, will be attacked by a powerful fleet unless you two agree to peace." Octavian, who gave due weight to this artful suggestion, reflected a moment and then said, Pompeius will have the worst of it. He has just been repulsed from Thurii as he deserves." Then the nervous cock, having gone over the whole controversy, led the conversation up to the death of Fulvia and the manner of it, saying that she fell sick because she could not bear the anger of Antony and wasted away with grief because he would not see her even when she was ill, and that he was, in a manner, the cause of his wife's death. So Fulvia is dead. Lady Macbeth of ancient Rome is
is no more
dead, and Antony left her in Greece and didn't even say goodbye, apparently. Just slammed the door and said, "Your butthole's not as tight as Cleopatra's," and stormed out. "Now that she is dead," he continued, the nervous cock that is, "it only remains for you to tell each other frankly what your suspicions are." In this way, the nervous cock won the confidence of Octavian and passed the day as his guest and begged him to write to Antony as the younger man to the older. Octavian said that he would not write to one who was still waging war against him because Antony had not written to him, but that he would make a complaint to Antony's mother because, although a relative and held in the highest honour by Octavian, she, remember, people may not know, but Antony's mother is of the Julian clan.
Yes.
So she is related to the Caesars. She's
dignitas. Yeah.
She had fled from Italy as though she could not have obtained everything from him as her own son. This was his device also for opening a correspondence by writing to Julia. As the nervous cock was going away from the camp, many of the higher officers advised him of the purpose of the army, and he communicated this and other things he had learned to Antony, so that he might know that they would fight against him because he did not come to an agreement. So he advised Antony that Pompeia should be called back from his ravaging of Sicily, and that Ahenobarbus should be sent some whither. Oh my God, it's not hither or thither, it's some neither wither. Is wither. Okay. That makes me think of something. Okay, shush. This is serious shit. It just doesn't work. Doesn't work as well. Sorry, Tom.
No. You tried.
Some wither. Until the Treaty of Peace should be made. Yeah. Send Ahenobarbus somewhere, some wither, until there's a Treaty of Peace. Antony's mother besought him to the same purpose, for she belonged to the Julian clan. Antony apprehended that if the negotiations should fail, he would be put to the shame of calling on Pompeius for assistance again. But his mother encouraged him to believe that they would not fail, and that the nervous cock had informed her, intimating that he knew more than he had been told. So Antony yielded and ordered Pompeius back to Sicily, implying that he would take care of their mutual concerns, and sent Ahenobarbus away as governor of Bithynia.
So what you're saying is that the nervous cock winked at Julia. He knew more than he let on. Never mind.
He wasn't really winking. It was just nerves. She thought he had a twitch. So they have this. So there's a sit down.
Yes, but there's so little trust. It's not the principal players sitting down, because who in the fuck knows what's really going on, what anybody's agenda is, and you can't trust anybody anymore. I just want to say that.
I went and turned my fan on because I thought you were going to go on.
Oh, so well, I could.
Antony sends Asinius Pollio. Octavian sends a young equestrian, Caius Macinus.
Right.
One of his confidants. And the army sent somebody who they thought would be neutral, the nervous cock.
Right.
He's there to sort of sit in as a neutral party. Yeah. Lepidus sends no one.
Casper the Friendly Ghost?
Because no one gives a fuck about Lepidus right now.
Right. And you got to just know that the nervous cock, his job was to make sure, look, they can divvy up, pardon, pay each other off, whatever. But at the end of the day, there will be no fighting. We will not kill each other because we know each other. These aren't strangers. We fought together. We bled together. We're not going to kill each other for their further glory. Fuck that. Make sure whatever happens at the end, that there is peace. It can be ugly. It doesn't matter. Make sure there's peace. And he does his job.
Yeah, yeah. He had this great speech that I've heard. He says, "We will not fight them on the beaches.
We will not fight them in the streets. We will not fight them at all. Went a little bit JFK at the end there. Ich bin ein Berliner. I can't do Boston.
Oh, look, that was good. Yeah. So there's another powwow. They're working it all out. And I just want to throw this out. And who knows if it's true. Again, you need a time machine. These guys are not pals. These guys are not buddies. But they both bring something to the table the other guy needs. And but you got to think their relationship is certainly more complex, or I don't even know what word to use. Maybe just a little closer than it was a couple of years ago when they first started working together. So again, there's no love lost between these guys. They don't love each other. They don't probably even like each other. But at least they're getting to know and appreciate the other person's abilities. And at this point, they need each other. Sextus Pompey won't cut it. Hanna-Barbera won't cut it. For whatever is going on right now with the multiplex, what the hell for the fucking word I'm trying to think of. But anyway, from just everything that's going on, they need each other right now, and that is what it comes down to. They can't defeat each other, and they certainly wouldn't want to have to deal with the mess if one of them was able to defeat the other.
And I guess at this stage, after 3 or 4 years of thinking Octavian was just going to go away,
yeah,
or die, or, you know, wimp out.
Yeah, something, yeah.
Antony's finally realized this little bitch ain't going anywhere.
He's a player.
Yeah, he's a player. I got to deal with him. Yeah. And, you know, wow, you got to give Octavian credit for that. He has.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, I have to keep reminding myself that when Caesar died, this kid was a, you know, puny weakling. Never done anything, came from nowhere.
No experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah, nothing. Yeah.
Nothing. Weak, you know, weak constitution. He's sick a lot of the time. And he's just turned himself into this complete badass, man. It's
And he's not going to stop. And he is not going to stop becoming the person he either wants to be or needs to be.
Mm. So they do a deal. Ahenobarbus gets a pardon. Octavian gets all of Gaul, and Calenus's legions are officially his. Antony gets the east. They basically split the empire right down the half, neatly in half. Octavian gets all the west. Antony gets all of the east, and Lepidus gets Africa because there's nothing there and they don't give a shit.
I just to give everybody a reference point, the line of demarcation runs through Scrota, which is in Illyria, just above Greece. Now, my
nervous cock, spell check. The nervous cock's favorite place to go was down to Scrota. He didn't feel whole. Check. Whenever he left Scrota, he didn't feel like he was whole. He used to say that.
No, something's missing. Something. Anyway, so it did change it to Scrotum. But anyway, so it's in Illyria right above Greece. So that's the dividing line. All of that, the Spains, Gaul, everything, you know, even the part that was Marcus Antonius, it all belongs to Caesar, the good and the bad of it. And as we're about to find out later, there's a plenty of bad to go around to match Antonius's bad of dealing with the Parthians.
So, yeah, and Lepidus gets Africa.
He gets dick.
Yeah, he gets dick. Not nervous cock. He doesn't go there, but, you know. And Italy is to be common ground where both Antony and Octavian would be allowed to recruit soldiers.
But Octavius has got to clean it all up. That's his job to clean up. Because the people are still starving. Sextus is still cutting things off. There's a whole bunch of people who've been protesting in Rome. That is his mess to clean up. Deal with it.
Yeah. Sucks to be Sextus. Like 10 minutes ago, he was friends.
Yeah, he was a hero. He was a part of the legitimate government, and now he's back to being an outlaw or a pirate.
Mm. Now, Octavian did do something that we haven't touched on yet to try and buddy up to Sextus, but we'll talk about that in a second. One other thing that happens, though, when they do this deal is Antony says, listen, there's something I should probably tell you, Octavian, old buddy, old pal. That guy that you have the other half of the heart pendant with.
Yeah, Rufus.
Salvidinius Rufus.
Yeah.
He's been secretly trying to negotiate a deal with me, between just him and me. He's been trying to come over to me.
Oh, man.
So Octavian, he obviously gives Octavian some proof of this, maybe a letter, maybe...
Yeah, because why wouldn't he lie? Yeah, yeah.
Maybe the other half of the heart necklace that Rufus scratched out Octavian's name and scrawled Antony's name on there. Any, whatever the evidence is, we don't know, but Rufus is immediately called to Octavian. Where he gets presented with this evidence. He's arrested and then either executed or committed suicide, depending on the source. And he's not the only one who is executed. Appian writes, Antony put Manius to death because he had excited Fulvia by his accusations against Cleopatra and had been the cause of so many evils. He also revealed to Octavian the fact that Salvidinius, who was in command of Octavian's army on the Rhone, had had the intention of deserting him and had sent word to that effect to Antony while he was besieging Brundisium. This secret Antony revealed not with universal approbation, but because of his real frankness and eagerness to show his goodwill. Octavian instantly summoned Salvidinius to Rome, pretending that he had some private communication to make to him, that he should send him back to the army. When he came, Octavian confronted him with proofs of his treachery and put him to death and gave his army to Antony, as he considered it untrustworthy. Now,
good call.
Here's what I don't get.
Yeah.
Ahenobarbus gets a pardon.
You're right, right.
All of the guys that fought with Brutus and Cassius get a pardon.
Yes, Antony did that when he was in the East, yes.
All of the guys that fought with Lucius at Perugia got a pardon.
Yes.
Lucius got a pardon.
Yeah.
But Salvidinius, who has been with him since Apollonia and we're led to believe possibly a childhood friend,
right,
does not get a pardon. How bad do you have to fuck up to not get a pardon out of this guy? He's pardoning everybody, more or less.
Well, I've got this weird theory that I really can't even put into words.
I mean, mark on the base of your penis there. mark.
Half heart shaped on my penis. Do you have one? Anyway, no, I can't help but think these guys almost go to war, ruin everything. They come together painfully, slowly. They make a peace. It's almost like they both have to sacrifice something. It's almost like a religious sacrifice or so. I don't know. So he kills his friend.
A bit like Marcus when Antonius they did the prescriptions, you have to give up someone.
Yes.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So I don't know. I couldn't help but get that feeling. So yeah. So he lost his wife, but Marcus Antonius at that point probably wanted to lose Fulvia because he was pissed at her. So they both kill off someone who was to some degree important to them, and it's almost like their new partnership is sealed in blood. I just couldn't help but shake that feeling when I was reading that.
Yeah, you might be onto something there. And just to remind, I mean, we haven't talked about Rufus much or Agrippa. Somebody sent me an email saying, why haven't you mentioned Agrippa yet or gone into detail on Agrippa? Well, it's because there's honestly not a lot of detail to go. I've even got a dedicated biography on Agrippa.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not a lot on him yet. He can't jump into it yet because there's not a lot of material.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of Agrippa. Agrippa, you know, obviously is a major, major part of this story, but it really, most of it happens down the track. Although he's obviously Octavian's right-hand man in many ways here, but the histories don't have much to say. The ancient histories don't have much to say on him yet. Yeah. But anyway, but to get back to Salvidinius Rufus, so he was with Agrippa and Octavian Apollonia in 44, Ides of March, when Caesar was assassinated, comes over with him. He's been with him every step of the way. In 42 BCE, he commanded the fleet of Octavian against Sexipe. However, he was defeated in a battle off of Rhegium, probably because his crews were inexperienced and also he was inexperienced. Again, I think he might be a little bit older than Octavian, but not by much. So again, fairly inexperienced, all of these guys. When Octavian returned from Greece after the Battle of Philippi, Salvidinius was sent to Spain with 6 legions, but he was pulled back then when Lucius was at Perugia to help out there. And he, with Agrippa, you know, surrounded Lucius's forces at Perugia with the circumvallation, so he played a big role in that. After the Prusian War, Octavian sent him to Gallia as a governor with the 11 legions that he got from Calenus. And he was designated to be the consul in 39 BCE, even though he was not 40. He had never been a senator. He'd never been anything, but as we know, the rules don't matter anymore.
Now, those are long gone.
And I wondered if he'd been set up by Antony, because if...
Yeah, that's what I would have done.
If Antony is still trying to weaken Octavian...
Absolutely.
You want to take
out... Get him to kill off one of his own.
Well, take out all of his main guys. You want to take out Agrippa. You want to take out Rufus. You want to take out Balbus. You want to take out anyone who's advising him and helping him. And so maybe he was set up. I don't know, but very sad for Rufus. He could have been... You know, one of the guys who was around for the next 50 years, but not to be.
Just like Agrippa was. But here, let's flip that on. Let's flip that for a second. So here's Caesar, 24-ish years old, remaking a deal with Marcus Antonius, who is older than him, more experienced. He's the real fighter of the two. I mean, what kind of person do you have to be to kill or have killed your good friend, someone you've fought together, bled together, you put him in charge of some stuff. I mean, you're breaking my heart. I'm going to send you away. Don't ever come back. If you do, I'll kill you, whatever. But no, he just has them executed on the spot. I mean, am I reading too much into it? What does that say about this young Caesar? That he was just practical as any other Roman?
Yeah. I mean, I assuming that the evidence presented was...
right, legit.
Yeah. I mean, he's got, well, look, you're one of my closest friends and advisors. If you're trying to betray me...
Right, who the fuck,
you know, I can't have you around. I can't trust you anymore.
Yeah, look what happened to my dad.
Yeah.
My adopted father. Yeah, good
you
point.
You got
to
go.
Sorry.
Dio writes, this man, Rufus, was of most obscure origin, and once, while he was tending his flocks... because he was a shepherd, you know, before Apollonia. Mm-hmm. While tending his flocks, a flame had issued from his head.
No. Sorry, go ahead.
And the earth is only 6,000 years old.
And the birds. No, go ahead.
Let me read this and we'll get back to the flame. But then he had been so greatly advanced by Caesar as to be made consul without even being a member of the Senate, and his brother, who died before him, had been laid to rest across the Tiber after a bridge had been constructed for this very purpose. We don't know anything about his brother, but obviously highly respected. But nothing in the life of man is lasting. And he was finally accused in the Senate by Caesar himself and slain as an enemy both of him and of the entire people. Now, this flame is a weird story. We hear about these sorts of stories, signs in the sky, you know, premonitions of the birth. Right. But they usually seem to be written much later on when people are trying to justify why Octavian became Augustus or why Caesar was so victorious, you know, or why Alexander was such a great conqueror. They're written decades, centuries, something later, trying to justify with mystical portents why the person achieved as much as they did. But this guy didn't last long enough for any of that. So why is there a weird flame story? I don't really get it. What do you think's going on with the weird flame story, Ray?
I who in the knows? In case he actually lasted longer than he sadly did not. Maybe there was going to be something to it. Maybe it was the beginning of something or just some local gossip. You never know. But I don't know. I just, again, we all know it's crap. Who knows why someone starts saying that they saw something when clearly they did not. Or I'm wrong and he's a god.
Oh, whoops. Sorry, Cheap Trick.
Another night slowly closes in, and I feel so lonely. Touching heat freezing on my skin, I pretend you still hold me. I'm going crazy, I'm losing sleep. I'm in too far, in way too deep over you. I can't believe you're gone. You were the first to be the last. Wherever you go, I'll be with you, Rufus.
No problem.
Everybody now.
When you're a shepherd.
That is so biblical. Dude,
that's
so shepherd.
Can I just say that is probably the first decent song choice you have suggested in the entire history of us working together. You're getting it. You're finally getting it.
I'm getting it. Coming up with obscure fucking techno tracks or something. Yeah. I've seen them live.
Oh, really? That'd be great. I just want to do more Cheap Trick songs now, man. Like cheap.
There we go.
Like cheap
there
trick.
We go.
Fucking awesome. Can we get in? You know, Surrender. We could. We should be able to get in Surrender in here somewhere.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Lord
knows. Let's keep that in mind. All
right.
God, this is a long episode. We might have to break this up, man. Like we're going on forever here. Where are we? Dio, Rufus, flame coming out of his head. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, but then everyone else gets a pardon. Caesar brought, again, Yay. Dio says, Caesar brought himself to receive under a general amnesty all those who'd gone over to Antony in the war with Lucius, Antony's brother, among them being Domitius Anabarbus and some of the other assassins of Caesar, as well as all those whose names have been posted on the tablets or had in any way cooperated with Brutus and Cassius and had later embraced the cause of Antony. And now I love this insight by Dio. So great indeed is the perversity that reigns in factional strife and war. For men in power take no account of justice, but determine on friend and foe according as their own interests and advantage at the time dictate. And accordingly, they regard the same men now as their enemies, now as their friends, according to the occasion.
Yeah.
There you go.
Do what you got to do, B. That's how I rolls.
Well, I tell you, that's a good motto for the Cold War, right?
Yeah.
Stalin, dude, we love you. Oh, Stalin, what you're doing up there on the Eastern Front, 27 million people dead. We couldn't 95% of war expenditures coming out of Russia. We fucking could not love you more. We're gonna be buds forever. Stalin says, well, thank you very much. I could do with a big loan now to help rebuild Russia. A loan from us?
No. We can't trust you, asshole.
What have you ever done for us, Stalin? Well, how about a security buffer zone around Russia to stop the Germans and the Japanese invading again? Security?
Yeah.
Fuck you. What have you ever done for us, Stalin?
We're your security. You got our word on this.
Yeah, we've got an A-bomb.
That's right. We'll use it on you. I mean, we'll use it on your enemy if anybody attacks you.
Anyway.
Anyway.
All right, let's bring this bitch home, man.
Yes, yeah.
So we mentioned...
So this is the end of the last Star Wars movie when the ships are going by and there's fireworks going off. It's peace, love, and happiness reigns throughout. That's right.
So all this is going on. Fulvia's dead, as we mentioned. Appian has something on this. While these events were in progress, the news came that Fulvia was dead. It was said that she was dispirited by Antony's reproaches and fell sick, and it was thought that she had become a willing victim of disease on account of the anger of Antony, who had left her while she was sick and had not visited her even when he was going away. The death of this turbulent woman, who had stirred up so disastrous a war on account of her jealousy of Cleopatra, seemed extremely fortunate to both of the parties who were rid of her. Nevertheless, Antony was much saddened by this event because he considered himself, in some sense, the cause of it.
No shit.
But on the other hand, he's single. Woo!
I'm single, bitches! Woohoo! Sorry. Is that inappropriate?
Now, recently, Octavia's husband, Marcellus Wallace,
do you feel that little sting? That's your ego fucking with you. Sorry, Pulp Fiction line. I should have had it recorded. I don't have it.
It's a good.
Octavia, being Octavian's sister, mm-hmm. her husband died. Yeah. And there's this cunning plan that Octavian has to marry her off to Antony in the same way that his dad, adopted mm-hmm. dad, Julie Caesar, married off his daughter, Julia, to Pompey to sort of cement their alliance in the early days of the triumvirate, the first triumvirate. Octavian's going to marry off his sister to Antony. Problem, slight problem. Roman law says that 10 months have to pass before a widow could remarry.
Okay, I'm sorry. I got to step in here. The father of four daughters, call bullshit on this. If I'm a married Roman man and my wife pops it and she dies, I can get married practically anytime I want. A woman, a widow, has to wait 10 months. That's sexism. That's unfair. That's the men, the rule makers making the rules. That's some bullshit. Okay, I'm finished now.
And why do you think they had to wait 10 months?
I guess to see if there was a baby?
Yes.
But still, if men can do it, fuck them. It's not all about penis, vagina, whatever, you know.
But the I'm guessing here, I'm totally guessing, but I think we've touched on this before.
Yeah, yeah.
Their concern was that these women would marry a rich guy, get knocked up by him, then kill him, poison him.
Kill his ass.
And then.
Right, or fuck him to death.
Yeah, then have the baby and then inherit all the money.
Right.
You know, remarry the stable boy who they're really in love with.
Yeah.
You know, they're rich. So they had this.
It's a low budget film I'm writing. But anyway.
The law says she has to wait 10 months, and Octavian and Antony obviously don't want to wait. So they get a priestly ruling to give them an exemption.
Yeah, they do.
Gotta love a good priestly ruling. By the way, when they were there, they said, is the earth 60,000 years old? And even the guys then said, are you a fucking moron? No.
Oh,
look,
no.
God damn it. look at the pyramids of Egypt, dipshit.
Oh my God.
They've been here for thousands of years. What do you think, you know, people turned up one day and built pyramids the next?
Who were the guys before the Greeks? Minoans? I'm trying to remember the very first show we did on Alexander. But, I mean, shit, even they're like a couple thousand years old. So, you know. Anyway, but they make a big show of finding a priest who gets them this special one time only. We promise we'll never do this again. Exemption, so they can rush the marriage and therefore seal the deal, because there is nothing more Roman than sealing a political alliance with a marriage.
Now, she was a bit older than Octavian. Octavia was about 30. She'd already given birth to a son to her dead hubby Marcellus, and she was pregnant. Mm-hmm. Whether or not they knew that, I'm not quite sure at the time. But Plutarch records that Octavian was deeply attached to his sister, who was, as the saying goes, a wonder of a woman.
Aww.
I'm not going to play the Wonder Woman theme, but I was tempted.
Wonder Woman!
He knows that Antony is this drunk, womanizing sort of douchebag.
Right.
And he's going to marry his favorite sister. Okay, and his sister over to him.
This is going to work out wonderfully.
Yeah, but they appeared to have a happy marriage, at least in the early years, according to the history, for some reason.
Well, see, right, what gets me is that we've read a lot of books, you know, doing the show, whatever, and one of the things I picked up on was that, and again, as the father of four daughters, this is totally not fair, but the women were literally raised to please their man, to be good wives. So she might not like Mark Antony. She may hate him. She might have heard horrible things, whatever. But once, and she has no control, she has no power. Once her brother, who is the paterfamilias, says she has to marry, she will, and she will do everything she can to be a good, dutiful wife and make him happy. And with, I think with Mark Antony's temperament and ego and sensitivity, almost like Pompey the Great, because she's able to praise him and stuff like that, he's actually pleased. And so at first, the marriage seems to be genuinely affectionate, or at least they're genuinely getting along and things are looking good, you know, as they start out as a married couple.
On the wedding day, she said to him, "So you're going to stop fucking Cleopatra now, right?" And he was like, "What? Are you crazy? She's no. She's pregnant with my twin sons. No, I'm that's not getting right. stuff fucking. What are you?
No,
what?
I think it's a boy and a girl.
Oh, okay. Anyway, he's no like, problem. No, I'm not gonna. I'm not going to no, stop fucking no,
I
Cleopatra.
Can't,
are you crazy?
I can't stop.
Yeah, just can't. You know, you get my house, which by the way is Poppy's right. old house. Nice house. You gotta like that's the right. house.
Nice house.
You gotta like the house.
You could get lost in this house. Why don't you go get lost?
Yeah, please. So they had some sort of arrangement, I guess.
Right.
So anyway, she does, by the way, appear on coins with Antony.
Yes. Yes. Good for her.
Which makes her the first woman to appear on Roman Woo. Currency. So, yes, he was going to bang Cleopatra, but she got her head on a coin. So there's a trade-off.
She gets to be in the history books, and I thought it was going to be Fulvia who was going to be the first one because she was so power hungry. Well, oh, guess who else had their own coin for a short amount of time? Titus Labienus Juniorus. I saw a picture of it on the internet. So he had wow. so when he was running around, he had his own coin for a while.
Titty pussy bum on a coin.
Yes. Yep.
Now, Asinius Pollio is now one of the consuls, and Virgil, who we've talked about, wrote a poem predicting, uh-huh. it would mark the beginning of a new age. He wrote, because there's now peace between the triumvirs, there's a marriage to seal the deal.
Peace!
He writes, "The great line of centuries begins anew. Now divine justice returns, the reign of Saturn returns. Now a new generation descends from heaven on high. Only do you, pure Lucina, smile on the birth of a child, under whom the iron brood shall at last cease, and a golden race spring up throughout the world. And in your consulship, Pollio, yes, yours, shall this glorious age begin. These," he said, "will be golden years."
Golden years, golden, blah, blah, blah. Golden years, golden, blah, blah, blah. Golden years, golden, blah, blah, blah. Don't let me hear you say life's taking you nowhere. Look at the sky, life's begun. Nights are warm and the days are young. There's my baby lost, that's all. Once I'm begging you, save her little soul. Last night they loved you, opening doors and pulling some strings. In walk luck, you looked in time. Never look back, walk tall, act fine. I'll stick with you, baby, for a thousand years. Nothing's gonna touch you in these golden years. Golden years, golden years.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one, the only.
Oh,
never to be repeated.
What a guy. What a guy.
Yep.
Yeah, so a new golden age, 1,000 years, come get up my baby, is what Virgil wrote. Now, Virgil mentions a baby boy, but he doesn't name him. Some historians think it's the anticipated offspring of Antony and Octavia.
Well, they just know that he is going to hit that relentlessly because that's the kind of guy he is.
But she was already pregnant, so, you know. But anyway, it turned out to be a baby girl. So much for the golden age. It was not to be. Now, Octavian also remarried. Who did he marry, Ray?
He married a woman that I hope her face was prettier than her name, Scribonia. She was the sister of Sextus Pompey's father-in-law, Lucius Scribonius Libo. So one, was he just trying to get in good with a Sextus? Like there's a general connection between the two, but it almost must be said that Lucius Scribonius Libo was his own powerful man. He had a powerful faction. He was rich and influential, so there was no harm in marrying him. But yeah, he had married her before he marched to Brundisium. So again, Marcus Antonius is thinking, oh my God, are they going to gang up on me? So the entire thing was in a state of flux when all that was going on. But yeah, so what she was like 10 years older than him. Hopefully that was a lot of sexual experience she was bringing to the marriage. I don't know. But I don't know much about this. Hopefully you've got something, but I can't picture him doing anything other than making a practical decision to marry her. I doubt if he looked at her and went, oh, she's the one for me. I mean, I just can't see him doing that.
Yes. He's doing, you know, he marries her at some point in this whole thing when he's trying to figure out a way to get Sexy P on his side. He figures, well, now we're family.
I can't fight me now.
Didn't really work out. Now, she's already been married more than once. According to Suetonius, she was married to two former consuls. We don't know who the first was, but her second husband was Publius Cornelius Scipio, who was a supporter of Pompey. So you can imagine that she was on that side of that story, and now she's married to Caesar's heir.
Taking it from Caesar.
And by the way, she was still married to him when Octavian decided he wanted to marry her. So she was forced.
It's good to be the king.
It is. She was forced to divorce her husband and marry Octavian.
Damn.
However, it didn't last long, but it did lead to them having a daughter.
Aww.
Julia the Elder.
Nice.
Born in 39 BCE, probably in or around October. She was born on the very same day that Octavian divorced Scribonia.
Tacky. Sorry.
But he has offspring. It's a girl, but he has offspring.
Yeah.
So,
just in case.
You know, and Julia the Elder will, you know, play an important role in future stories.
Oh, yes.
She's a great character.
She will not be the apple of her daddy's eye, but that's for later.
Well, she would be the apple of a lot of men's eyes. a lot of men's eyes throughout the empire.
Sometimes in the same day. But anyway, that's for later. So we have peace once again. We got marriages all over the place. We got babies popping out all over the place, including the boy and the girl twins that Cleopatra is going to he probably had at this point, I'm not sure, or going to have, whatever. So it's nothing but good times. Now they can focus on cleaning up Rome, deal with Sextus, deal with the Parthians. Everything is looking good. You can't see right now, but I got both thumbs up. Hey, everything's fine and dandy now.
Hey. Well, that's the end of this episode, which I think is probably 18. I have no idea where we are. I think so. I think that was 18.
It's one of the teams. It's definitely a team. Yeah.
Let's plug a few things. Don't forget to check out the hillsdale.edu/LOC Winston Churchill series, free. Our Cold War series will be starting end of March, so keep an eye out for that. We'll shoot you an email if you're on our mailing list. Be on Facebook, and we'll mention it here, I'm sure, with the URL and all that kind of stuff when we're ready to go. Also, the video of us in Vegas with David Markham, Life of Caesar slot.com/Vegas.
It's a hoot.
I'll be appearing live. In, no, that's not true. I'm not appearing live anyway.
That's not true.
Thank you, Ray. We'll be back.
Thank you,
Cam. Same bat channel, same bat time. We'll be right back.